I'm Clint. I'm an alcoholic. California Clint. I was just kidding about that part, Elmer. Jesus. I'm delighted to be here. I appreciate very much being included in your 32nd annual convention here in the state of Florida. And I'm delighted to be sober. And I have, in the time that I have been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's been my privilege to meet and love a lot of members of AA. And this is really an interesting organization. I don't know if there's anybody here tonight that is new in their membership in AA, but I suspect that, in fact, I'll just ask that. If you're new, and let's say if you're in your first 6 months of sobriety in AA, would you just raise your hand just for a drill? This is Jacksonville's Lost and Found Department. Welcome. I welcome you to AA, as does everybody here. Welcome. This is a place where you will, in the book it says, we are people that ordinarily might not or would not mix. And it's true. And you'll find that this is quite an adventure in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love it here. I love being sober, and I love my membership in AA. I guess it was last year now, I called my office for messages during the day, and my secretary said, well, you certainly have an interesting life. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, I didn't know you were going to be in Cincinnati this weekend. And I said, I am. How do you know? And she said, well, I'm looking at a note here, and it says that the guy that's going to meet you at the airport in Cincinnati will have a wooden leg, and he'll be holding a big book. And sure enough, he had a wooden leg and a big book under his arm. And turned out he was Bob. His name is Bob. I spoke to Bob again not long ago on the phone. He called me up, and we had a wonderful time that weekend. I got to know Bob. He was a Hell's Angel before he got sober, and he lost that leg in a motorcycle accident, and he kind of looked like a Hell's Angel. He had an earring and all of that. We went down to the parking lot. He had a Pinto down there, and I was glad. You know what I'm saying? I kidded him from the podium that night. I said that wasn't really an earring. Bob had got caught in the park by the Ohio State Wildlife Commission, and they tagged his ear and made him go to AA. But we had a great time. We really did. And we've had a wonderful, wonderful time here this weekend with you. And I'm delighted that Elmer asked us to come out. We had dinner with an old friend of mine from Southern California tonight, a transplant to Florida, Steve and his lady Debbie. Steve, when he was in California, worked out a new set of promises for a rather colorful group there. I liked him. It said, the first one, I'll just tell you the first one, it said, you will come to know your full name and address. It was... It inspired us, I'll tell you. Steve and Debbie are an item, you know. It was casual for a while, and then one of Debbie's, I guess a great uncle died and left her a lot of money. A lot of money. And right away, she and Steve started going together. Although, in fairness to Steve, I want to say this. I think that he would have taken I don't think it mattered to him. I think he would have become interested in her no matter who died and left her all that money. I I'm delighted that there are so many people here in their first 6 months of sobriety. This is not, I started to say this is not AA, and it is not AA. This is a convention of members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and AA is something that happens within each of us someplace else. I mean, you can't point to anything in anybody and say this is AA. AA is a set of principles. AA is a way of life. AA is many, many things. But here we get together, I suppose, as much as for anything, to celebrate, to experience the joy of life that we share now, to share, as your slogan says, this year's slogan, the share the sparkle. There is an extraordinary feeling for me in any congregation of members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have had an extraordinary trip. The journey has been just wonderful in AA. And I got to AA, when I got here, it was not any elegant way to get here. A bail bondsman brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have the bail bonds people down here in the fourth row. I don't know that the guy brought anybody before, and I don't think he's ever brought anybody since, but he brought me to AA in Glendale, California. And at the time, I was not doing real well. I was living in a garage in Glendale with three other guys. A double garage, but still. And I knew this man because he'd bailed me out of jail more than once. In fact, he'd given me a job selling encyclopedias door to door. So in those days, I lived in a garage with three other guys. I sold encyclopedias door to door, and when I could get out of bed and when I didn't wake up in jail, and life was not particularly good. And I had done it all by my best judgment. My quality of life was low. There wasn't anything about my life that provided hope or inspiration to me. There wasn't anything about my life that made me feel like I had a purpose on this earth. There wasn't anything about my life that created in me the need to be of service to anybody else or to make a contribution any place. The main point of my life was for me to stay as drunk as I could, as much as I could. And when you live like that, you wind up going to jail on a regular basis. At least I did, because I had very little control over my conduct when I drank. I just abandoned all kinds of control over it. There's a line in the book that I think is interesting, because it refers to this odd notion that we have, if we're alcoholic, that someday we will be able to control and enjoy our drinking. Now, those are two interesting words in the same sentence when you talk about drinking. Control and enjoy. I never did. I enjoyed it from time to time, and I think on one or two occasions controlled it. But you don't control and enjoy your drinking if you drink like I do. I just wanted to be out of it. I just wanted to be gone. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I discovered that if I was alcoholic, I was always going to be alcoholic, that there never would be the time that I could control and enjoy my drinking, I really didn't like that at all. You mean to tell me that I'm not building up any good drinking time by hanging around you people? Oh, that was a dreary notion to me. Just awful. I hated the idea that I would never be able to take a drink again if I was alcoholic. And I struggled with that for a while. A friend of mine named Hank talked about that idea from the podium, and it was some comfort to me. I'll pass it on to you. What he decided was he was going to donate his body to science. And he got to thinking about that. When he died, they'd take his body to a teaching hospital or something like that, and some pathologists would get a hold of it, and they'd dissect out his liver and send it someplace and put his kidneys in a drawer somewhere, and they'd get around to send his eyes down the hall to the eye bank, and they'd finally get around to dissecting out his brain, and he figured when they did that, they'd drop his brain in this big jar of alcohol. And he got to thinking about that, and he thought, if that doctor listens real close, when he drops my brain into that jar of alcohol, he'll hear, ah. I like that. So if you're new here and you've caught alcoholism, you'll never get over it. You're stuck. And that's just something that we have to come to terms with, and I struggled with it. I struggled, though, with being an alcoholic. I never really... And I thought when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you were going to say, are you an alcoholic, or you are an alcoholic? And nobody ever did. But I did get asked an interesting question, a question that comes out of the phraseology, that brilliant phraseology in the big book, because the question I got asked was, are you powerless over alcohol? Now, if you ask me if I'm an alcoholic, I got about 10 definitions for that, none of which include the way I act when I drink. But if you ask me if I'm powerless over alcohol, that's a whole different... Because I know what alcohol is, it's not really subject to much definition. And I know what powerless is. I mean, I just know in my gut about powerless. And I've known for a while. I knew real well in those days. I mean, powerless is when they say, get in the car. And you get in the car. You don't want to get in the car, but you get in the car. At first you don't, and then they get this stick, and they go, what? They just tap you a little with it. And you get in. Get in the cell. With them? You get in. I like that. You want to know about powerless, they say, just relax your hand, we'll do it. And they roll your finger over there like that. That's powerless. I know about powerless. I know about laying under my bed one night in that little... The garage was cut up into four little rooms. I had one of those rooms. And a male alcoholic's room is a wondrous thing. I'll tell you, they really do it right, don't we? It had a linoleum floor, a sticky linoleum floor. I could hear myself walking across that. Your feet stick to them. Had a little cot. Had a bad odor in there. The odor of mattresses gone bad. Oh. Had a sink. And the toilet was out someplace. Toilet's just a rumor. You don't need the toilet. You got the sink, you know, and it's... And I lived like that. I lived, and there's one more, a male alcoholic's room has got one more. We do not give up our social life easily, and so there's an old copy of Playboy magazine laying around in there. Boy, that's a wonderful life, isn't it? Sort of like, honey, I'm home, you know, when you... And I woke up in that little room one morning, it was still dark. Just enough light coming in that I could see a little bit around the room. It was coming in under the door. And I was under the bed. Up on one elbow a little bit, and I could see the rat over in the corner. And he was a big one. And you know how you have that rich reality in those moments? And I knew he was going to come for me and take out my cheek. And I stared at that thing, and he stared at me. There was an evilness to it that I just... And I would kind of leave the room a little bit. I'd pass. I'd come back in there. He'd still be. And I watched him, and he watched me, and I was afraid to move suddenly. I didn't want to startle him into something. And I felt totally defenseless, and I would pass out, and then he'd still be there. And finally, I don't know what time it was, but a little first light of dawn came in a window, and I looked again, and in some magical fashion that rat had turned into a pair of socks laying over there in the corner. That's alcoholism, you know. All I wanted to do was be cool, and I got held hostage by a pair of socks all one night. Sometimes it's better to wake up in jail, you know. I mean, in jail, at least you know the drill. You wake up needing a drink, and then you realize where you are, and you don't somehow need the drink quite as bad then. You know, you're not going to get a drink. Waking up in jail lends predictability to your day. You know the routine. I know I got to go stand in front of the judge, but I won't get arrested. I did get arrested one morning at 10 o'clock for drunk driving. A shocking miscarriage of justice, I might add. I'd pulled up to a stop, the light was red, and I stopped. Sort of a citizenship thing with me. I just, you know, made my little contribution there. And the light turned green, and amber, red, green. I was resting. And the guy right behind me is in a squad car, and so pretty soon he's up rapping at the window. He got me out of the car and had me touch my nose and stuff like that. In those days, I wanted your badge number. I want justice. You know what I mean? We had a little discussion about that. He arrested me. My sponsor, years later, I have a sponsor. It's one of these step Nazis. And name of Clancy. Don't get hostile now. He told me I shouldn't be going for justice. He said, you've had about all the justice you can stand, probably. Go for mercy, maybe, but not justice. So they got me into that car in downtown, and we went through the fingerprints and all of that. About 3 weeks later, I was in an office, and I'm looking at that police report. And this guy said, he had kind of a different view of it. He said, I discontinued the field sobriety test because the suspect was injuring himself. Yeah, and I want a jury trial, right? And it went that way. I had a lot of warrants out for my arrest when that bail bondsman brought me to you. I was way behind on the child support. My mailing address was General Delivery Glendale, and it was. And I had no notion when he brought me to you that it would be possible for me to go any time without a drink. And he got me here in July, that hot summer in July that year. And I came, I was around for a few weeks, and then I left, and I came back in August on the 14th, and it's been some years now. I was 29 years old then. The year was 1966, and next month I'll celebrate 22 years with you, and it's been here in this room. I'm 51 today, and I have more energy and more vitality and more promise and more love and more capacity in my life today than I have ever, ever had before. And I love it in AA. I love it here. And when I came to you, I was not doing so hot. You were doing fine. And so there's been an extraordinary transformation that has taken place in my life by virtue of my membership in this program. I mean, I was talking to a guy today, a new resident in your town, a man by the name of Duke, who retired here from Southern California and he lives in a retirement community and could not be here today, but next month on the 15th, he will celebrate 48 years of sobriety. He got sober in 1940, and I love this guy. And he called me at the hotel today, and we talked. And he's a dear man, and he has some extraordinary stories to tell about the early days in Akron and in New York. And I cherish that friendship and that bit of history that he adds to my life. And I know what this program means to him. And it just warms me so much that there are people here that have the extraordinary sparkle of this program. I love seeing Hal here. It's a treat to see Conway. I really got a kick out of Leo last night. He has that marvelous energy. About kick these flowers to death. Poor devil. Elmer told me, stay. The flower budget is shot. Don't anybody kick these flowers anymore. But I love it here. I love it here. I was, my sobriety, I think, has been kind of, these 21 plus years, the first 5 years was a time of finding the program for me because I started out skeptical. I didn't dare hope that anything would happen to me that I could come to love. I mean, I had no credibility with myself about drinking. I loved those pills. I loved those uppers. And I didn't think I could. In fact, that's how I got started on that last drunk. And when you told me that is not the way we do it, that we really do not take anything, I was terribly frightened because I did not believe that I would be able to make that be a reality in my life. You mean no Dexedrine, no Dexamil, no booze, nothing? No, nothing. You just got to do it. But you only have to do it a day. It's like postpone that next drink until tomorrow. That's all. And you know, you put together a day like that, and you put together two, and you put together a week, and you put together a month, and I guess I was sober about 6 months when they let me set up the chairs in the Monday night Glendale participation meeting. I loved it. It gave me a feel that I had the right to sit down in that meeting. I had the straightest rows of chairs in town. You know, boy, those chairs were, I'd already gone from selling encyclopedias to selling ballpoint pens. Spent my first year selling imprinted ballpoint pens. But it was all right. I got to that club, and sometimes I'd go to the meeting in those first early months, and I would think, after the meeting, I'm going to have a drink. And something wonderful happens to us at these meetings, because after the meeting, I never had to go do that. And I get to the meeting thinking that I'll leave afterwards and go get a drink. The day is too crappy, and I just can't make it, and it's silly to go to bed at night with the same knot in your gut that you wake up with in the morning. And I never had to do that. I mean, as soon as I get their stupid chairs set up, and then it was as soon as the secretary shows up, and slowly things began to change in my life. Slowly I began to make little turns. I remember when I was 9 months sober, I used to, on Monday night, one Monday night a week, a month, about five or six old-timers. So one guy with 12 years, one guy with 8 years, one guy with 6 years, a woman with 10. Four or five would come into that room and they would meet there. And from there they would go down to put on a meeting in one of the institutions in Los Angeles. And when I was 9 months sober, they asked me if I would go with them. Well, I was thrilled because I had watched these people and how attractive they looked and how much they loved one another and how much fun they seemed to be having with one another. And it just thrilled me that they included me. And I went and asked the secretary of the meeting if I could do that. And he said, yeah. I mean, you can't get it on any higher authority than the secretary of the meeting. And we went down this long flight of metal stairs and hung on the side of the laundry in Glendale, California, over which the meeting was held. And we got into Bill Christian's old Chrysler that was parked in the parking lot. I sat in the middle in the back seat, and I listened to these people chatter and laugh and carry on as we drove down the freeway, and I was just delighted to be included. And we pulled off at Norwalk, and we were going to a mental hospital, and we pulled into the Metropolitan State Hospital there. We pulled into the grounds, and we stopped the car and started to get out, and it hit me. Oh, God. This is the way they do it in AA. Oh. Six of us are going in there to the nut house. Five of them are coming back out. Oh. I'm getting so slow. I should have had it at the... And my next thought was, I can outrun every one of these old fools. And I had... The next thought was an interesting thought. An astonishing thought. My thought was, if these people think I belong in that nut house, maybe I do. And it was not a day at the beach walking across that parking lot, but I did. I walked across, and we went in the mental hospital and in the day room, and the orderly brought in the patients from upstairs, and they sat down in their white robes and their paper slippers. And we sat there, and they put on a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I read chapter 5 because they told me to, and I didn't do another thing, and I wondered how I'd look in paper slippers, is what I wondered. And in an hour, we stood up and we held hands and we said the Lord's Prayer, as we do. And the orderly took the patients out and back upstairs to the ward, and the six of us walked out, and we got into the car, and I sat in the middle in the back seat. And slept in my own little bed that night. It was all right with me. And it was, I guess, maybe a few days later that I realized I had trusted somebody for the first time in years. I mean, with my freedom. It sneaks up on you. You don't know where you are quite sometimes until something happens and you get it. You sit in these meetings and you see somebody take that cake or that chip and you go, my God. And you find yourself loving that person and really glad for them. And shocked and surprised and delighted to discover that you have a positive emotion that doesn't have a self-interest tag on it. It's an extraordinary experience, this journey. At the end of that first year, I had my driver's license back. We're making real progress now. I had an apartment of my own. I got a job selling dictating equipment. Had a salary. I mean, we're moving right along. My progress has not been... The first 5 years was like... And toward the end of that second year, I moved out to the west end of Los Angeles and got my sponsor and took an inventory and a fifth step and began to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and involved in its activities and go to lots of meetings. And I just really loved the fellowship and everything that was going on. And it was just terrific. And... When I was a couple more years sober, I got another job. And I wound up, when I was 5 years sober, selling carpet and for one of the mills. Not a bad job, but I didn't like selling carpet. And I was sniveling around about that a lot. And some guy made an odd suggestion to me somewhere toward the end of my fourth year of sobriety. He said, why don't you go to law school? And I looked into it. He said, Why don't you just stop sniveling and go to law school? And I found out as I looked into it that it takes 4 years to do that. I mean, I got to work during the day. I got to go at night. I got to go to meetings at night. I got to. And I went back. I said, "Do you know how old I'll be in 4 years if I go to law school?" He said, "Well, how old will you be in 4 years if you don't go to law school?" Carry the one. I don't know. And those 4 years go by. And in 1975, they had a graduation ceremony at Whittier College of Law, and a lot of AA members were there that year. And then I had to get ready for the California State Bar Examination, which is a tricky little test. It takes 3 days, and you sit downtown and with 3,000 or 4,000 other men and women, and you write down everything you know, or even think you know, about law. And there's a sterner test than that for guys like me. They want to, it's interesting, they have an application that you have to fill out. And in that application, they get to some pretty colorful questions. Like, list your residence address since you were 16 years old. The guy I studied with had two addresses for that entire period of time. Two. I had columns of addresses. 2 weeks here, a month there. The garage. The Pontiac. Then they get on to the sterner stuff, like, have you ever been convicted of anything other than a minor traffic violation? And they leave three little lines there. I wrote, see attached page. There was some of it, you know, it's not easy to put all that down. I had worked 4 years and I'd worked very, very hard to get through law school. And the state of California has an abiding, and I might add, legitimate interest in who it issues licenses to. And they wanted to know who we were, and they wanted to know who I was, and they really wanted to know it all. And I didn't want to put it down there because I was pretty sure that if I told them the whole story, that would be the end of that. And I called up my sponsor. And I said, we got a problem. He said, what's that? I said, they want to know about all these arrests and convictions that I've had. He said, yeah. I said, well, there's one, I'll tell you, there was one that, and maybe two that I don't think are on the record. That night I high-centered my car in the rock garden in Vista. Yeah, I don't know. Nobody ever, I spent the night in jail, but he said, yeah. I said, well, I don't want to put it down there. He said, oh, I get it. They're just asking for the ones you want to put down there. Is that the... I said, no. And you know, you brace yourself. If you got a sponsor like I do, you expect you're going to get a lot of information all of a sudden. You kind of... But you know what he did? It was a very interesting thing. He pointed out to me, as he has on many occasions, how practical this program is. He said it this way. He said, you don't have to put it all down there. But you won't pass the bar examination if you don't. What are we into? Zen now? Is this some sort of... I didn't say that. I don't talk like that to my sponsor, but that kind of... He said, the way that it works is this. If you don't put it all down there, you'll figure they'll catch you. And since they're going to catch you, you won't get ready for the bar examination. And you won't pass it. And now I knew that we're getting a little close to home. He said, on the other hand, if you put it all down there, everything down there, they may not let you take the bar examination, but if they do, you can give it the best shot you got. And you'll probably pass it. And I knew he was right. And I did. It took me 3 or 4 more days, and I wrote it all down there on their form, bundled it up with twine, and sent it. And they let me take their test. And I sat down there for 3 days with all those people. And at the end of the 3rd day, I put my pencil down and went to an AA meeting. And I had to wait 4 months to find out if I passed. And I found out that I had passed. And they gave me a license to practice law in the state of California that year. And I had passed it the first time. They wouldn't give me a license to drive a car when that bail bondsman brought me here to you. And so that 4-year span, and the next years after that were years of coming to know and love a way of earning a living. I love a way of making a contribution, of providing service, and it was wonderful, and is wonderful. I had known. It's interesting what an extraordinary effect Chuck C. had on my life, because every time I heard that man, there was something that I came away with. And he's dead now, and he was sober many, many, many years in AA and had a profound effect on a lot of people. And he said one time, if you're working 5 days a week just to get the 2 free ones at the end, that's self-robbery. And I knew what he meant, and I knew I was doing that. I knew that it was the 2 days at the end that was all I lived. And I sponsored people that loved their jobs and loved the way they earned their living, and I envied them that passion in their lives. And that motivated me. Because I have such a conviction that, and Charlotte mentioned it, I think we can have anything we want here. I think it's available to us. I just can't believe that we're sober just to exist. And to have no passion in our lives, to have no sense of making a contribution, to weep no tears and laugh no laughter. I think it is all available here. And I came to know that I could make a contribution. And I had, during those years, not paid much of attention to relationships in my life. I had had relationships, but I had not paid attention to them. I had not cared for them. I had not nurtured them. And about 4 years ago, it was suddenly so clear to me. It's kind of funny. You know, we grow up and we make our little vows about what life is all about. We make decisions based on some experience or another that, oh, it's this way. Fine. Is that the way it's going to be? Okay. And right behind that is, I'll show you. I can play your game. And someplace along the line, I decided when I was, I think, maybe 7 years old, that I did not trust women. An event in the 2nd grade that took 3 minutes and a misunderstanding between me and a teacher. And that was it. That was the end of it for me. And given that, you're going to have some difficulty with relationships. And I knew it was all their fault. These women, somehow, remarkably, had all been sent into my life to hurt me. It's a sad story, and I know you... Yeah. Oh, it's interesting. When I was at Boca Raton 6 years ago, I guess, there was another speaker there by the name of Tom. Tom and I were friends then, and we are friends now, and I've had many a talk with him. And we got to talking about this one time. And I was at the end of yet another relationship, and I said, she just can't be intimate. He said, who can't be intimate? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, how many have you had? How many women have there been? And a little later on in the conversation, he said, would you like to take a look at that and do something about that? To which I replied in true alcoholic fashion, "I don't know." And then he asked me another question. And now the volume is going up. He said, "Well, who should we ask?" Don't get snippy, Tom, please. I've got more sobriety than you do. I mean. So I entered into another phase. I didn't drop AA when I went from that first phase into working out a career, and I certainly didn't drop AA when I began to make an effort to see if there wasn't some way that I could have a relationship with somebody. And it's been an interesting thing. It's been an interesting thing. And there is a lady, and we will spend our lives together. She's here with me now. Say hello, please, to young men. Would you stand up, dear, and just say hello to these people? Thank you. Thank you. And we have had our moments earlier today, as a matter of fact. But you know, we work it through. We work it through. I'm one of these guys, and I really, when I get annoyed, I don't like to say it. Because usually what annoys me is a little tiny thing. And I shouldn't be annoyed at that. I should rise above it. But I want her to get that I'm mad. So I withdraw. I get a little cold. I get a little distant. It's a cute game to play, you know. It is such a... I really hate that I am so practiced at that I'll go into it just like that. And I have been given an assignment about that. And sometimes I do the assignment, and sometimes I can't do the assignment. But the assignment is... If you're going to play that game, that's great, but announce it at least. Let everybody in on it. So the announcement, if I can make it, goes like this. I'm mad. And I'm also supposed to announce how long I'm going to pout about it. And why? I'm upset. And she knows I'm under this assignment, so she says, "Okay, why?" Well, you know, this morning when we pulled into the parking lot, we were driving there, and you said, "There's a parking place right there." Let me tell you something. I've been driving a long damn time. I don't need you to be telling me there's a parking place right there. And so for the next 4 hours, I'm going to be a little distant. I'm not going to really answer your questions. And if we run into somebody I know, I'm not going to introduce you to them. Well, at least now she knows, you know. And you can't really get through the announcement without just hooping about it. I mean, it's... See, as long as I have it up here, where no sun shines, I know it's not enough to be that upset about. And what do? I go get 3 more things from last month to kind of... And she's wonderful with it. You know, it's like she just does her own thing. I mean, she continues to be the extraordinary human being that she... You know what the moon does when the dogs bark at it? It just goes on being the moon. But you know what happens with that, and you know why? If you're new here, there's some information that you might find interesting. You'll be told to work the steps and go to lots of meetings. And that is wonderful, wonderful advice. And you should do that, of course. I mean, if somebody tells you you don't have to work these steps, get away from that person. Get away from them. They will transform you. They will allow you to learn to live in a world in which you feel welcome and loved and comfortable. And this is my opinion, but I have a feeling about it that is stronger all the time. My notion about it is this. The reason you might want to go to lots of meetings is because something wonderful happens to us in a meeting. When we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, we have all this stuff in our head. Chuck C. used to call it a grand central head. Just endless whirring of all of those thoughts and guilts and terrible feelings about ourselves. And we're up here constantly. And we never seem to be able to get into the room with one another. It's not safe. See, the reality is in the room. It's the tables and the chairs and the people and the coffee. It is not up here in our heads. And I think it's the only choices that we have. I mean, I'm either going to be up here in my head or I'm going to be in the room with you. I don't have much choice other than that. Maybe I think the Eastern religions carve out a third possibility. If you get really good at meditating, that may be another alternative. But for me, I have two. I can be up here brooding about nothing, or I can be in the room with you. And it's so interesting. I loved a talk I heard not long ago in California. This guy is named Jack, and he was talking about how what happened. The story that he was telling was he was in a AA's home, a big home in Los Angeles, for a party. And he and somebody else were standing in the kitchen, and the other guy said, "There is a beautiful lady from Honduras in a red dress in the living room. You ought to meet her." And he said, "Great." And they could kind of see her through the crowd there. And as they were walking from the kitchen through the dining room out there to see the lady, Jack's thought was, "My God, I don't want to live in Honduras." You know, it's just, whoo. We don't have any business up here much, you know. But it's like having a tooth out in your jaw. You can't keep your tongue out of that thing. And we just go up there. And something in a meeting happens, and it's absolutely wonderful because somebody will say something from the podium that will get you in the room, where you can hear the laughter and feel the love and get the feelings. And we get a little peace, a little rest from all of this. For just a few minutes, two guys about the same length of sobriety, the same emotional condition, go to the same meeting, and they leave, and one guy says, "God, that was a wonderful meeting. I know he was in the room." The other guy says, "That's the most boring meeting I've ever been to." Guess where he was? Guess where he spent the meeting? And I've done it. Or we come in and we stick around for a little bit, and when there's no problems, which is in itself, of course, a problem, we go up here to find the problems. God forbid we should be out of a problem for a little bit. But we get a taste of it here. We learn here that reality is safe. And for a long time, only the meetings were safe. It was not safe at work or on the streets or in any place else. But the meetings were safe. And so go to lots of meetings. It will calm you down. You will get in the room more and more. You will sort of... I remember hearing Alan McGinnis from the podium one night in L.A. He's the guy that wrote the speech that was ultimately to become that pamphlet called A Member's Eye View of AA. He died sober some years back, but he said one night, "There's only one time that any of us can have a conscious contact with God in discussing step 11, and I'm thinking, boy, this ought to be good. And he said something that I never expected, but I've never forgotten. And he said, "The only time that any of us can have a conscious contact with God is right now." Like here in the room. I asked Chuck C. one night, I was driving him to a meeting We had plenty of time to get there. It was some distance out of L.A. And I said, if we take this road, we'll save 15 minutes. He said, what are you going to do with it?
What are you going to do?
He was wonderful. I said to him one night, I said, you go up to L.A. all the time and talk. How can you stand to do that? He said, what do you mean? I said, all that traffic. Doesn't that drive you nuts? He said, son, I just drive the one car. I drive every car I can see, don't you? So go to lots of meetings. Now, there's a reason to work these steps, and this is my opinion, but it seems to me with all this stuff going on, if there was some way that we could take a paper and a pencil and write that stuff down, it would kind of transfer it out into reality. Kind of give us a chance to air it out a little bit. That's step four. If we read that to somebody else, that'd be step five. It drains the swamp, is what it does. Six and seven are the same thing. To go through that material and to see where we've contributed to the problem. You know, it's funny, we endlessly discuss defects and shortcomings. And I think that for me, it's pretty simple. If there is an event in my life, it is just an event until I connect with it with a character defect. Then it becomes a problem. And I know the difference between an event and a problem. The problem gives me a knot in my gut, and it's usually because I've attacked the event with a character defect, like envy or lust or sloth or whatever. And when we get that we can have either events or problems, and it's pretty much up to us, it gives us some responsibility. It really isn't the guy in the next lane on that freeway, you know. And that's freeing information. Out of that comes the notion that life is fair, and it is. And then what we have in our lives is pretty much exactly what we want. Most of us are driven terribly by those people we've hurt. And if we could make a list of those people and make amends to them, it would further calm us down. And it does. It took me 12 years to pay all the money back. I paid my father-in-law back that $14,000 I owed him when I got here, and I was glad to have it done. There was one more on the list. There was a guy whose sofa I had burned up years earlier. Oh, he was mad about that sofa. And I finally said, okay, I'll get rid of this one too. It was the last one on the list. I sent him a letter. I sent him a check. I told him I'd been sober in AA for a while and that I was sorry about the sofa. And within a week, he sent me the most marvelous letter back. He was so happy I was sober. He loved it that I had joined Alcoholics. And he sent the check back and told me to donate it to AA. And maybe someday I will. I might. It could happen. You know what? When you do that, your income goes up. Isn't that interesting? You kind of get the flow going. It's interesting. So if you're new, go to meetings and work these steps. They're extraordinarily vital. And they will increase the quality of your life in ways that you cannot imagine. I'm not anything like the person that I was when I came here. And I am one of those that believes with Charlotte that you can have it all. Everything that you want, you can have. There's only a couple of things you got to keep in mind. One of them is that we put sobriety first. And the second one is that you have to, if you want it, learn how to get it for yourself. Because if you expect somebody else to provide it for you, you will never learn how to get it. And that goes for peace of mind, a job, an automobile, anything at all. And we can have it all. And then the question, of course, becomes, what are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with that peace of mind? What are you going to do with that serenity? Where will your contribution be made? What will you do? There's some, to me, a very touching motto. Whenever anybody, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there. To always be there. And for that, I am responsible. And somehow or other, that's taken on a broader meaning for me in these last few years. I had to form a different purpose for my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'd been around a while and I didn't want to get jaded. I had to form a different purpose for my relationship with my sponsor. And we do and should. If we're growing and moving, we should keep these wonderful things in our lives and we should make sure that we have a purpose that's currently satisfactory to us. And my current purpose is to be the very best member of Alcoholics Anonymous I can be, to make the contribution that I can make here. But more than that, I think AA asks of me to make a contribution out there. And you have taught me to be squeaky clean where I go. And when I go into the courtroom these days, there are 12 jurors in the box that are expecting the lawyers to lie to them. And after a 6 or 7 day trial, they find out something unusual. I have not lied to them. And when it comes time for me to ask them to vote, they will listen very carefully to what I have to say. It's interesting to take this program and make the contribution out there. And the results are extraordinary. And I think we are doing our very best when we're doing whatever we're doing 100%. And our employers and our fellows and our creditors like it that way a lot. And you know what? There is a time, I think, in our nation when we really must, as citizens, give it the best shot we have no matter what we're doing. And I learned that from you. I learned that from you. This is not AA. AA is with each one of us. And as we leave here tomorrow afternoon after we hear Conway talk, we're going to get an opportunity to do whatever we're doing 100%. To be in the room with one another and to love one another. To be here and to do what we do. And we learn it here in these rooms because it's safe here. And I've enjoyed so much being in this room with you tonight. Thank you.